Hello and welcome to Hindsight. Michelle Rayner with you this afternoon here on ABC Radio National. Today we're heading onto the streets of inner Melbourne for an urban history that's deeply etched into some of the key political and social transformations that took place in Australia last century. The inner city suburb of Fitzroy is a place with many layers of history and association. There's the vestiges of boomtime Melbourne in its remaining bluestone mansions and terraces, while its warehouses and tenement buildings tell another later story of Fitzroy, one where generations of working-class families lived and worked side by side. And in its current incarnation, as a gentrified, high price tag inner city address, it can be difficult to read those earlier stories and connections written into the fabric of its streets and back alleys. And for certainly many of its present-day residents and the shoppers and diners who frequent Fitzroy, the long association that Aboriginal people have had with the suburb might come as something of a surprise. Since the beginning of the 20th century, as missions and communities around Victoria were broken up, Aboriginal people started coming to Melbourne, and it wasn't long before a community had established itself in the inner suburbs of Fitzroy and neighbouring Collingwood. Today's feature, The Black Mile, uncovers the history of urban Aboriginal Fitzroy, which is also the story of the Indigenous struggle for social and political rights. It's presented by Koori writer and actor John Harding, who came to live in Fitzroy with his family in the 1960s. Here then is The Black Mile.
Fitzroy was the best place I ever encountered. It must have been. I'm still here, 37 years later.
Now we take a walk to Fitzroy. Early in the morning.
Fitzroy community has, since the 30s and probably before that, been an incredibly historically important Aboriginal community.
We stand outside the cellar.
This must have been a congregating area for blackfellas way beyond 1788, or else why would we still be unintentionally coming here?
The charcoal man. Quarter light, everybody. And I remember sitting in the laneway.
I want to pay my respects to particularly people like the Beryl Boots, like the Jan Chessels, other people that were part of this street and very much part of this street. We owned it.
With some friends we knew who said they knew our father.
The best story I tell people was when Muhammad Ali came to town. He pulled up Court of Gore Street, Gertrude Street, Friday afternoon, and I reckon 800 people just appeared out of nowhere. The trams all stopped, the cars all stopped, and it was just total chaos.
Now the lanes were not forgotten.
And at that time, Fitzroy was full of Aboriginal people, not like now, and it was sort of home to everybody, and everybody knew everybody, and all the hotels, and they were all open to them, and,
you know, all over Australia, Blackfellas knew that when you come to Melbourne, you go to Fitzroy. Even if you went looking for anyone, if you come to Melbourne, you got to go to Fitzroy. And if you didn't do that, then you were, you know, coconut. So, you know, you had to go there. And you also had to pay your respects to the Parkies.
Historically, this is an important place. Founded my family here, you know. But the thing was, everybody knew. Everybody knew my family. Families knew families. Everybody knew everybody.
Acting just like children in the joy we gave each other. We were dancing round the jukebox in the Champion Hotel.
That's singer-songwriter Archie Roach. He came to Fitzroy in the mid-1970s. A few years before I started hanging out in Fitzroy as a teenager. My mother, Eleanor Harding, who was from the Torres Strait Islands, and my father, Jack Harding, lived in a boarding house in Gore Street, Fitzroy, in the early 60s, along with my brother and sisters.
City lights are driving me crazy as I walk the lonely streets of old Fitzroy.
I'm a Gunjamara woman, and I'm an elder. I was born just up the road, just before the gardens, in Fitzroy in 1935.
Arnie Ulmer-Thorpe is speaking in the Atherton Gardens, Fitzroy, in February 2009, during the unveiling of a series of plaques commemorating the history of Aboriginal Fitzroy.
My mother was relocated to Fitzroy in the 1930s because women who were 15 and 16 had to move off the missions so that they would not marry into their own people. It was part of the, well, I always call it genocide, and that was a government policy.
In the dream time, hear the didgeridoo drumming in the night, where the cobberies are seen by the firelight, far away from the glow of city light.
The Aboriginal community that formed in Inner Melbourne in the 1920s and 30s in Fitzroy and Collingwood came about partly because of the government's assimilation policies. The Half-Caste Act of 1886 forced young Aboriginal people, deemed to be of mixed race, off the missions in the hope that they would be absorbed into the general population. This policy, along with World War and economic depression, forced Indigenous people into the city to find work and to re-establish a community.
It was a gathering place, you know. For some reason, that's the place people picked, probably because it was close to where people came from. They'd come to Spence Street Station or Flinders Street from Gippsland or from the Goulburn Valley, and they would gather at, you know, particularly in a suburb, and that was the one that people picked, you know. In terms of majority of people picked that one.
You know, it was a very much working-class area. There was lots of cheap accommodation, just like boarding house type accommodation. And I guess because one family moved, then other members of that family moved into the same area because, you know, they were able to offer support to one another because they were close by.
And it was the cultural hub, you know, the social hub, the religious hub. People went there to meet their families, and it's very similar to what, you know, in the old days before the white man came here, we'd have a place where we would gather. And Fitzroy was one of those places.
Some Aboriginal families also came to Fitzroy after missions were sold for soldier settlements. Eugene Lovett's parents came to Fitzroy in the 1940s, when the Lake Conda Mission in southwest Victoria was given over to returned soldiers. Eugene's father was also a veteran of World War II, but he received nothing.
He went to war, Second World War, went to New Guinea and a whole lot of other areas during the war, and it's one of the 23 Lovetts who went to war, and fortunately, they all return, and that's when the soldier settlement things sort of come into it, and they close the mission down. So really, they had nowhere to go, and they decided to come to Melbourne. Yeah, they were one of the first Aboriginal families, or Indigenous families, down there, and it was them, the Boops, the Austins, Thorpes, I think. But they're the moments, sort of families I grew up with.
And where were they living?
A lot of them were rented houses then, you know, rooms in Gore Street, George Street and all that around Fitzroy, and down home in Collingwood.
They lived, at one stage they lived in a boarding house up near, on the corner of Brunswick and Gertrude Street. As I said, there was lots of boarding houses there operating at the time, and that was the cheapest accommodation you could get.
Bev Murray's late mother, Auntie Nora, came to Fitzroy in 1941 from the Cummeragunja Mission on the Murray River in northern Victoria.
My mum, when she was about 13, 14 years old, she grew up at Cummeragunja Mission, and her mum and dad, they walked off with all the other residents as a form of protest. So there's, you know, in our history, we call it the Cummeragunja walk-off. And that's where Aboriginal people just packed up from that mission because of the conditions, because of the manager at the time, and decided that they would live outside the mission because they wanted to have control of their own lives. So my mum, along with her siblings and my nan and grandfather, then ended up in Melbourne because that's where there was more work. A lot of women got jobs in factories. My mum She worked in some of the factories around Collingwood, Fitzroy, when she was very young. She tells a story about how they used to hide her when the inspectors came because she was too young to work there. But, you know, they had to work because, you know, it was a way of bringing income into the family.
In the 1930s, Fitzroy Aboriginal community, which at the time had a significant component of refugees from Cummeragunga up in the Murray River, those refugees formed the core group who formed two of the earliest Aboriginal political organisations in Australian history. The first of those was the Australian Aborigines League, set up in Fitzroy in the 1930s by William Cooper and Marge Tacker and Bill Onis and Doug Nicholls and others.
Gary Foley is a long-time campaigner for Aboriginal rights, who helped set up the Aboriginal Ten Embassy in Canberra in 1972. He came to Fitzroy from Sydney in the early 1970s.
Those early organisations, through its involvement with the Day of Mourning protest in Sydney in 1938, served to put the Aboriginal political struggle into national and international attention.
Well, the Cummeragunga walk-off in 1939 was a result of political action that had been taking place in Fitzroy. People from all over the place got together and had meetings. Joyce Johnson, you know, they had meetings in her house. And, you know, the Briggses and Pastor Doug, they were all from Cummera, you know.
One of Fitzroy's best-known and respected elders was the late Pastor Doug Nicholls. He moved to Melbourne from the Cummeragunga Mission in the 1920s after getting an offer to play football with Carlton. Uncle Doug saw his sister taken by police from Cumbra, and as a young fella joined the pioneering Aboriginal activist William Cooper to form the Australian Aborigines League in 1932.
Aboriginal people saw the opportunity then to use the white man's system to, you know, create our own organisations and advocate more formally for basic human rights for Aboriginal people. You know, we're talking about a time when, you know, Aboriginal people didn't vote, weren't encouraged to vote. You know, we were treated as, you know, subhuman in some areas of Australia.
My grandfather was one of the leaders with William Cooper and Doug Nicholls and that, who formed the Advancement League.
Eugene's grandfather, Ebenezer Lovett, was also a member of the Communist Party, whose headquarters was in Fitzroy.
Yeah, he was with the Communist Party. The reason was they were the only organisations or people who'd support Aboriginal land rights, and not only land rights, but Aboriginal rights in general.
Where would they meet?
There's a little church in Opie Street. There's a little church there. I think it's a Baptist church now, across from the flats. But that was their original office in them days.
In the 1930s, the Communist Party of Australia was the only political party, and it was a legitimate political party. They were the only political party in Australia that unconditionally supported independence for Aboriginal people, economic independence, political independence, meaningful self-determination. Some of the most famous names in Aboriginal history had both clandestine and overt relations with the Australian Communist Party. Those people include Kath Walker, Faith Bandler, and old Marge Tucker, one of the legends of the Victorian Aboriginal political movement. Marge Tucker was the only Aboriginal woman from Victoria who attended the 1938 Day of Mourning demonstration in Sydney.
Jesus Saviour, I am waiting to repent from sin. Now for Thee, my hope forsaking, come and speak me pure within.
Auntie Marge Tucker came to Fitzroy around 1930, after she was forced to leave the Cummeragunga Mission. She was a founding member of the Australian Aboriginal League and pushed heavily for rights for her people through the socialist press. Years later, in the 60s, both she and my mum were members of the United Council of Aboriginal and Islander Women. Auntie Marge also famously organised the first Aboriginal debutante ball in the late 1940s in the Collingwood Town Hall. She was also involved in social activities at the Gore Street Church, which Uncle Doug Nicholls started in 1943 after becoming a pastor.
The Gore Street Church is pretty prominent in our family, but also for a lot of families that were in Fitzroy that didn't want to go to pubs, they'd go to the church.
A lot of people went there to meet people, but, you know, we just didn't meet in pubs. We also met at the church, and a lot of marriages probably would have also came out of those meetings.
And that church became a major meeting place, I guess, for Aboriginal, young Aboriginal people. In fact, I'll tell you, some of them from that time will tell you how they met their future partners through that congregation.
Down the way where the nights are gay and the...
Doug Nicholls not only held religious services for all, but he had guests coming whenever an overseas visitor who was of perhaps African-American background came, like Harry Belafonte, Winifred Atwell, the pianist. He would get them down to the Gore Street Church. They'd perform and they'd be role models for people. So he was starting to talk about wider issues and wider Aboriginal issues, being proud of yourself.
Historian Richard Broome is author of the book Aboriginal Victorians.
The Australian Aborigines League that William Cooper started was still going then. Doug Nicholls was the head of that once Cooper had passed away in the early 1940s. And then, of course, in the 1950s, together with some white activists, he formed the Aboriginal Advancement League, and that was the other way he pushed political issues. So that Melbourne then became a centre for Aboriginal politics.
My grandmother moved us down here when I was six, and we went come down to Melbourne. We used to live in a double-storey terrace house here while she rented it.
Esme Bamblett is the CEO of the Aboriginal Advancement League.
We were in a couple of places in Fitzroy. We moved around a bit. We moved between Fitzroy and Cummeragunga and Maroopna. So we had the three kind of alternatives.
My husband and I came to Fitzroy in 1960. We were living in Gore Street, and because I didn't know many of the Aboriginal people then, because I was really scared of them when I used to see them, you know, because I wasn't used to this, all these people drunk on the street and rushing out at you and all that sort of thing.
Where did you come from?
Collarinnabri, New South Wales, northwest New South Wales.
Well, and just quickly, why did you come down?
Well, I thought it'd be a change from around, you know, and up in the Never Never there now. Collarinnabri is sort of a ghost town now because it's only one street. So everybody's sort of left.
Auntie Jan Chessels came to Fitzroy from New South Wales in the early 1960s.
We moved to Gore Street, which had nine rooms. In those rooms, we housed a lot of people then. You know, and Christmas, we'd have 30 people for Christmas dinner, and that'd be all the parkies. And how we did it, I don't know, but my husband was great. Sunday dinner for the men, you know, they were well looked after.
There's a land that is fairer than rain.
Made friends with lots of people. I knew the Ardens, Lovetts, Thorpes, Dowers. And then there was a lot too from interstate.
To prepare us a dwelling place there.
Traditionally, Aboriginal people have been oriented to sort of localism. And I think that's one of the remarkable things about the Fitzroy community, that was probably the first time that people in a significant way associated with each other. They had, of course, associated earlier by being moved around on missions, but in Fitzroy they mixed and socialised and began to intermarry. So that was really quite significant in building later pan-Aboriginal ideas and feelings, that they were, you know, all one group with similar ideas and similar aspirations.
Well, you always had your traditional identity, you know, nothing and no one could change that. And then, I guess, when you came to Melbourne, you were just one big, you know, homogenous mob of you know, blackfellas. And everyone knew everyone else, and it was like being a part of one huge family.
Bev Murray's older brother is Gary Murray, who was the executive officer of the Victorian Aboriginal Education Association in Fitzroy in the early 80s. Their father, Stuart Murray, was also a key player in Aboriginal politics around Fitzroy.
You know, the common thing with all of us was that we were dispersed. And we're dispersed traditional owners from elsewhere. You have a commonality, a cultural commonality with anybody else who's dispersed as well. So your brother from Gippsland, you look after him. even though you might come from Goulburn Valley. And that's what happened. We've got networks, we've got bonds, we've got relationships, marriages between groups. My guess is that when Lionel Rose won his world title, everybody reckoned that everybody was his cousin. And I reckon it's probably right, biologically. I really believe that. I reckon that if you map Victoria out now, given the information we know about people's connection, in terms of their genealogies and whatnot, we've married right across because of that dispersal.
So Fitzroy's almost a microcosm of the whole Victorian Aboriginal community.
Yeah, it would be, most definitely. I think, the fact that, say, for example, the Wimmera mob got taken over to Gippsland, and then people from there come to Fitzroy. You get people from all over the place, all in Fitzroy, but you also get these intermarriages between groups from that normally would not happen culturally. That's a good thing, because at the end of the day, you become multi-clan.
I was destined to come over and over to Fitzroy eventually. I mean, these guys at work, they said, you've got to go over to Fitzroy. I'll bet you find members of your family over there, you know. And so I went over there one night after work instead of going home with the pay packet. As soon as I jumped off the tram, this fellow approached me, an old black fellow, and I didn't know who he was. But he said, Charles, straight away. Pulled me up, you know, I got a shock that somebody would know me, you know. I didn't know anybody in Fitzroy, you know. And it was black, and I was frightened. There wasn't many black fellas in the Box Hill Boys' Home during the 14 years I was there. You know, I asked him, you know, how does he know me? And he says, oh, you know, your mum, Lancy Charles, you were Lancy Charles's boy. And then I asked about my mum, and he says, yeah, she's alive, living up in Swan Hill. And he says, where you been? You know, all that kind of stuff. And he realised I'd been taken. So he took us up to one of the pubs, and introduced me a lot of other black people in the pub and that, and people who, there's a cousin of yours, well, most of them were related. I opened my pay packet and shouted them all drinks. I wasn't a drinker then, I was still Christian, whitewashed.
Jack Charles is another member of the Stolen Generation who rediscovered his Aboriginal roots in Fitzroy. Like many other young Aboriginal boys taken from their families, Jack ended up in the Turana Boys' Home in Parkville, not far from Fitzroy.
When I arrived there, I saw so many other failed adoptees and fostered kids and that, you know.
They put us in Turana. They reckon we were uncontrollable, which we weren't. You know, we were getting bashed every day, you know, from our foster parents. And we got sick of it and started, you know, hitting back. Because we stood up for ourselves, we were sent to Turana and...
So Fitzroy was pretty close. I mean, would you escape from Turana and go to Fitzroy?
Yeah, well, this is where we first found out where our parents were, so... You know, there's people from different areas who know your parents and that. You know, their parents know my parents, and since they saw, you know, us there, well, they love us, yeah. Well, we know their parents, they live in Fitzroy. And that's how you find out where your parents are, so... The next step was, you hear someone's escaped and say, you're on board with them, mate, and off you go.
and what did your parents do when you first rocked up?
Got one hell of a shock, mate.
And where were they?
They were in a cafe, the Hamburgers, in Gertrude Street. Yeah. That was the meeting place, one of the meeting places for a lot of people, the Hamburgers, after the pubs closed. Went home with them, and then they rang the authorities up, you know, because they didn't want us to get in trouble, and they didn't want to get in trouble themselves, so...
And where were they living?
Nobby Street, just up in that little church.
Can you describe what it was like then?
Rough as hell, mate. Got the biggest fright of your life.
Why?
Well, I got brought up in orphanages and homes, you know, we had a hard life in there, but we'd never seen a cop. We'd never seen, you know, people fighting. We'd never seen a lot of things what happened in the street. We'd never seen people drinking, you know, consuming alcohol, betting in the tab, you know. We never saw big crowds. We come to Fitzroy, there was the biggest street fight. And me and my brother, Greg, we just looked at each other, you know, terrified.
Where was the fight?
It was in Gertrude Street, actually. That was our initiation to Gertrude Street.
The Builders Arms is one of six hotels here in Gertrude Street, Fitzroy, a street described to me tonight by one of the local shopkeepers as having a Chicago-like reputation for violence.
And what was the fight about, do you remember?
It's racial, our people, and I think it was the Yugoslavians. And right across the street, there was chains, broken bottles, knives, guns, the whole works were there, mate. And the cops, they took their time getting there, and they wouldn't get involved when they got there. Real good welcoming to two little kids,
Side by side, we'd walk along to the end of Gertrude Street. And we'd tarpaulin muster for a quart of wine. Thick or thin, right or wrong, in the cold and in the heat, we'd cross over Smith Street to the end of the line.
Singer-songwriter Archie Roach also came to Fitzroy in the 1970s. To reconnect with the Aboriginal family he'd lost. Like a lot of other men and women who identified as Parkies, Archie found a home in the parks and laneways of Fitzroy.
I thought I was just confused, just wandering around Melbourne homeless, and until I found out about Fitzroy, I was hanging around down the city before I ran into this Aboriginal guy and said, "Listen, you've been up Fitzroy lately?" I said, "Where's Fitzroy?" And he looked at me like I was stupid. He said, "That's where we all hang out, brother, all the black fellas."
And I ran to my sister Alma for the first time outside the Champion, old Champion Hotel, yeah, just across the road from here.
But we just made do with some city street blend.
My first memory of Fitzroy is really clear, still in my head to this day. I'd lived in Redfern for about 8 years before I came to Melbourne, and I had quite an extraordinary experience in Gertrude Street the first time I came here. I mean, I was in the Builders Arms Hotel, which in them days was the black pub of Melbourne. 10 o'clock at night, I walked out the front, a bit charged, and a taxi came down the street, put my hand up, and the thing stopped. I mean, being a bloke who come from Redfern, that was quite an extraordinary thing. And it left a deep impression in my mind. So I figured that, this Melbourne place seems moderately more civilised than Sydney. And within 2 years, I'd moved to Melbourne permanently.
And the next day we do it again. I'm a survivor of charcoal man.
As Aboriginal people moved into Fitzroy from foster homes, missions and country towns, they galvanised a national struggle for civil and political rights. Moving on from the pioneering efforts of the 1930s and 40s, Aboriginal people by the 60s had begun calling for full citizenship rights from the very streets of Fitzroy.
In the referendum, the first thing they had to get was a huge petition signed for it to be considered by the government as a referendum question. And I remember Alec Jackamos telling me stories about he and Doug Nicholls setting up a table outside the Collingwood football ground.
Doug and I was employed by the Advancement League then as a field officer, and there, we used to go up to Smith Street, Collingwood, with a little card table outside of old Foyne Gibson's. It's not there anymore.
The late Alec Jackamos was a Greek Australian who married Mel Morgan, an Aboriginal woman, in the early 50s in Fitzroy. He quickly became involved in Aboriginal politics and social life, and was a lifelong member of the Aboriginal Advancement League.
And Doug would be yelling out, "Give Aboriginal citizenship rights," and he'd be dragging people. And Doug was like chewing gum to anyone, because if he put his hand on them, they'd come right to the table, But we also had a good spot outside the Collingwood football ground on home matches.
I'm John Harding, and you're with Hindsight. Today, we're in inner-city Melbourne, uncovering the history of Aboriginal Fitzroy.
Well, the referendum, you know, like, God bless it, but at the end of the day it was about counting us.
By the late 1960s, young members of the Koori-Fitzroy community, like Gary Murray, were demanding Aboriginal self-determination and local community control.
There was an attitude change, and a lot of it was brought about by, you know, Aboriginal people having a more different approach, creative approach, radical approach, whatever you want to call it, but a different approach to how we exerted our rights and how we expressed that.
You know, Fitzroy, as a community, played a vital role in the transformation of Aboriginal affairs in the 1970s. This was an era when self-determination was the catch cry, and, you know, oppressed non-white peoples all over the world were making moves to assert their own independence. And so the instance at the Advancement League in when Bruce McGuinness and Bob Mazza started talking about black power meaning Aboriginal control of Aboriginal affairs, there was quite a dramatic reaction. In fact, events in Melbourne in the late 1960s, early 1970s, transformed the Aboriginal political movement nationally.
You mothers and fathers, you want your kids to grow up in a fascist country? Well, let's
you know, Brucey Mac passed on passion, you know, and that belief in black, you know, that black is beautiful. That black power movement was good for that. It gave us, wasn't the same as America, because America got a bit violent, but it was about black is beautiful. It's okay to be black.
It was activists in Fitzroy in Melbourne and Redfern in Sydney and people in Brisbane and Adelaide who became the core of the so-called Black Power movement, which through its Aboriginal embassy protest in 72 forced the most dramatic change in Indigenous policies by the federal government in history up until that point, and put the issue of land rights firmly on the national political agenda.
Since we got out and started doing things for ourselves, we've got legal service, medical service, we've got survival programs, we're providing services for the community, we're making that community go ahead as one, which is what the community wants to do.
I mean, it was really exciting because it was a time of black power movement was happening, so we were into black power. And, yeah, we had a... It was a great time, you know. I marched for everything going, really. I enjoyed myself anyway, but, you know, I think it was a good time for cultural regeneration, you know, for everybody.
In Fitzroy and Redfern, the Black Power movement put into practice its ideas about health in terms of setting up free, community-controlled, shop-front medical clinics to give some sort of reasonable access to people who were poor and otherwise would not be likely to be able to see a doctor, giving them an opportunity to get some sort of reasonable basic medical care.
Auntie Elma Thorpe, along with Auntie Geraldine Briggs, Auntie Edna Brown and Bruce McGuinness, set up the first Victorian Aboriginal Health Service in Fitzroy in 1971.
The health service that we did set up, and we worked 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. But we were open house. Nobody was paid till years later. From out of that philosophy of the being a healthy person in this country was our land rights and our own self-determination and sovereignty. And that's how we built, actually, the service on. Was those three things, a vision.
When the health service first opened down here, close towards Smith Street, that was more like a community drop-in centre. Yeah, you had some of us parkies, we'd be a bit, you know, a bit under the weather and a bit drunk or something, we'd go into the health service and we could even just sit down in one of the chairs and have a sleep and nobody would pay us any mind, you know, that was just a normal thing to do. Sometimes we could go in there and have a shower and Auntie Sissy or Auntie Edna Brown, they'd be cleaning up and they might cook you up something to eat.
Hey, I'll be in a lot of ways, mate. I went there a few times, you know, when I was on the run, you know, and I had a few injuries, you know, and they weren't supposed to do it, but they, you know, you got the doctor to see me and stitch me up here and there and do a lot of medical things, you know, without having to go to hospital and that. Not only that, they, you know, they were always there to talk to and, you know, I mean, it's confusing for someone to get out of jail when they're young and they've got no one, you know, especially when their parents aren't there. So you've got leading figures, which they were, and they were more than leading figures, they were more like mothers too. So I've got a lot of time and respect for those three women.
I stayed 3 years with health service, and then we continued on to Nindabaya. So Nindabaya started in 1976. And the old thing officers of it was to get all the men from around Fitzroy, Carlton, Collingwood, and all the areas to come in. And we had group sessions, and the old sergeant from Codsgrove, from Fitzroy, he sort of fell in love with the idea, and he supported us and bought us all sorts of, like, materials for the kitchen. So we started off meals on for the men, so they'd have breakfast when they'd come in, and they'd have tea before they'd go home.
Auntie Jan Chisels was a volunteer nurse in the early days of the health service. In 1976, she went on to set up the Nindabaya Workshop, a community drop-in centre.
When the Nindabaya started, they sort of kept away from the park. They came to Nindabaya. And the main thing was to look after the men coming in and out of jail. You have to look after their health, to make sure that they had proper food, and make sure that they got somewhere to sleep. Especially the ones coming out for prison, and not let them stay there in the Nindabaya.
But it's run by Aborigines. We can do anything we liked in there, you know. And if you didn't have a place to stay, well, Jan would sneak you in and allow you to stay the night and that, you know, with a bottle and that, you know. But, I mean, it was all done within reason, and we respected one another, so that we wouldn't do anything, we wouldn't go overboard.
In 1972, in the same building that housed the health service, the first Victorian Aboriginal Legal Service was set up in Fitzroy.
Well, Jim Berg and my father, Stuart Murray, and other people as well. But you know, we all knew that we needed to have legal protection, a legal service, because of what was going on at Fitzroy. There was a lot of police bashings and stuff like that. So, and a lot of other issues as well besides that. Opposed land rights legislation and... It wasn't just all about the criminal law, it's also about civil law. So there's a lot of civil matters that needed to be addressed as well.
You know, one of the things I can remember, the little cards they had in those days, and it was, if you're picked up by the police, don't say anything, don't, you know. And the reason was because our mob were so honest and that, and not only honest, but they'd pick them up and they'd admit to anything. And so the legal service had to, stop them. So I remember the card, don't give a statement, don't admit guilt because until you get legal representation. And very, very important, because up until then, most of our mob had been in jail. Because I remember the days when you had to have some money on you or else you were picked up for vagrancy. So a lot of our mob went to jail for 3 months just for vagrancy. For not having enough money around, which is just because of poverty. So, it's things like that, and the legal service stopped that.
We had representation through the Advancement League, but if you didn't plead guilty, well, they wouldn't get a lawyer for you. It was the legal service there that changed everything. It gave us a voice, and it gave us confidence in the courts that we'd get justice.
It was just like a health service. We needed a health service, we needed a housing co-op. It all happened. So we really went from the Aboriginal Advancement League in the 50s to the legal service, health service, the housing service, all within the space of 5-10 years for each other, and everything sprung from that.
The Aboriginal Funeral Service really got kicked along through the support given to it by the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service. I mean, the gymnasium in Gertrude Street is one of the offshoots of the Victorian Aboriginal Health Service when it first began.
I'm Glenda Thorpe, and I'm the manager at Melbourne Aboriginal Youth Sport and Recreation Co-op, which was formerly the Fitzroy Stars Aboriginal Community Youth Club Gymnasium. This place grew out of the Aboriginal Health Service, of course. There was old parkies and there was young fellas that were getting into a lot of trouble. And so the idea was ensuring that youth were looked after. What Jock was about was he was a passionate boxer himself, and he was the lead trainer, I'd say, with all the young fellows that had an interest in boxing.
Uncle Jock Austin was an important leader in the Koori community in Fitzroy, who set up the gym on Gertrude Street while he was working at the health centre. I remember Uncle Jock putting on one of my first plays in the gym in 1990. He emptied the top floor so we could get a stage and audience in. He saw the importance of the link between sport and art and believed it was vital to nurture the mind as well as the body. Jock set up the gym with the help of young people like Graham Skull Rose, the younger brother of world champion Aboriginal boxer Lionel Rose. Skull came to Fitzroy in the late 1970s from Gippsland.
When I first got here, I walked into the builders and I said, I'd seen my Uncle Jock across the bar and I said to him, Uncle Jock, I come here to fight. He looked at me and he said to me, what's your name? I said, Graham Rose. And he said, you're coming home with me. So that was it. That's how the Fitzroy Stars gym was open. Yeah. He needed a fighter, and I asked him. I was only 15 years of age at the time.
And I was there. We used to drive around with him, collecting all the stuff, all second-hand stuff from boxing gyms. You know, and that's how we did. We carted it upstairs and set it up the first gym with nothing, my brother, nothing.
The gym, the All Stars have been around for, you know, quite a number of years before the gym. The gym got set up for boxing, but once Jock sort of gained control and, you know, showed interest in looking after the kids and that, it sort of took the footy team under its wing.
Eugene Lovett coached the Fitzroy Stars to a premiership in 1986. I played wing in that legendary team. Koori singer-songwriter Kutcher Edwards was also a Fitzroy Star.
Back in them days, the football club was an amazing football club. It not only presented itself as the football club, but it gathered the community together.
Watching the All-Stars win, you know, they were a confidence builder, mate. You know, it wasn't just for a football team, it was for a community. It wasn't only black people, it was white people too, Maltese, Italians. It bonded people.
I ended up playing footy over there for Fitzroy Stars. After the footy, we'd go to the pub, Builders Arms. Builders Arms, Champion Hotel, the Royal Hotel, Grey Starling Hotel, that was the Black Mile.
Gary Murray again.
And that's where we'd congregate, and it was like going to church, Friday night and Saturday night. Because you would go there, and you would be talking to people and creating relationships and, you know, talking about whatever was going on and encouraging people to get jobs and all sorts of stuff, you know. It's still about creating that cultural hub and making sure that we're all getting together regularly.
This strip here, this little Gertrude Street here, this little street here, it was such, you know, some days even you'd be walking down there, like if you're going somewhere, you know, you probably wouldn't get there till an hour later just walking down Gertrude Street, talking to people, stopping talking to people, elders, young fellows, older fellows, you know, middle-aged, whatever, just talking to community, you know. It was beautiful, bro, beautiful, and it's very important. And it's slowly disappearing, see, it's slowly gone. I see it now, I look around and all I see is Ghostbusters.
People in the parks, kids in the parks, you know. And this is before all the shit hit the fan with all the drugs coming into Fitzroy and you could sit in the park, you know. There was, yeah, it was a family atmosphere. And it was very communal and barbecues and then, yeah, the drugs sort of forced a lot of people indoors. And, you know, that sort of happened in the, you know, late 80s.
And then as soon as, you know, people started to use drugs rather than just drinking, solely drinking, then, you know, all semblance of Aboriginality died with it, you know. Oh, you're a black person using, you know, drugs and that, you know, but your Aboriginality, you know, you forgot, you dropped the game.
Well, the pub started closing down, you know, getting renovated and, you know, more modernised now. The Royal's gone now, that's a pawn shop. The Champion's closed down, You had us, you had gangsters, you had, you know, you had everything. Like I said, footballers, boxers, you had everything. Now it's trendy.
86 we closed down. Well, the workshop wasn't there, and the health services moved up further towards Nicholson Street. So that all came very quiet around that area then. Then the hotels started to close.
I was only 15 when I met my brother, Dolores. He looked at me in his face, lit up for joy. And after the tears, he talked about our mother, held me close and whispered,
the population's moved further north and northwest, and it's not like it was. It wasn't, Fitzroy's not the hub that it used to be. I don't think we've ever really left, except in the sense that physically we've moved out in a way because of housing. Like next week, say, if there was a funeral and it was in Fitzroy, we'd probably be, and if that was a church in, say, Gore Street, we'd all be back at the Billwards, drinking afterwards at a wake.
It's home, mate. It's where I belong. This is where I first connected to my true Aboriginal roots. They're all here, and I'm sticking fat with the place, you know.
It's gravitational. It's something here in Fitzroy that it's a meeting place. And I said, and like I said before, we were here a lot longer than 1788. We've been coming here since time began, I believe.
And everybody knew the Parkies' law. And I see my brother standing on that hillside, and he's silent. F Troop doesn't ride here anymore. And I remember dancing round the jukebox with my brother. We were dancing to and singing, I can't help. Yeah, dancing just like children in the joy we gave each other. We're dancing round the jukebox in the Champion Hotel. We're dancing round the jukebox in the Champion
Singer-songwriter Archie Roach with his Lullaby to the Black Mile, which lies between Gertrude, Brunswick and Smith Streets in Fitzroy, and was home to Victoria's urban Aboriginal community for the best part of the 20th century. The Black Mile was presented by writer and actor John Harding, who himself grew up in Fitzroy, and the program was produced by Stuart Braun, with technical production from Carey Dell. More info and references can be found on the Hindsight webpage, abc.net.au/rn/hindsight. And next week, we're taking a look at the rather coy history of sex education in Australia, as seen through the eyes of Swedish expatriate writer and journalist Johan Gabrielsson. His interest in the story of sex in Australia came about when he was faced with his own son hitting puberty. What Johan hadn't anticipated was the fact that sex education in Australia, in marked contrast to the story in his own country, was deeply tied to war.
A Short History of Sex Education in Sweden, Part 2.
1955. Sex education for all children is mandatory. 1959. Condoms are sold in vending machines. 1961. Sex education programs are broadcast on TV. 1969. The Swedish Association for Sexual Education have now 42 stores all over the country. They sell books, clothes, and contraceptives. 1970. The Swedish Association for Sexual Education introduces billboards all over the country in the fight against gonorrhea.
A memory from Sweden in the early 70s. My dad is driving through empty streets in Stockholm. I'm 8 years old and on my way to a summer camp. It's 6 o'clock in the morning and already hot. We drive past billboards showing giant condoms. I already know what a condom is used for. My father says that we live in the best of worlds. No one is hungry, education is free, and the government is looking after us. Sweden is the envy of the world, and I should be lucky to be born in such a great country. But I don't care. I'm thinking of Åsa, a girl that will be at the camp. This is what happens next. Åsa and I will kiss, and I will try to put my hands in her pants. Åsa will tell her parents. Then her parents will call my parents. Then my mother will sit down with me and say that I have to be gentle with girls. She gives me a book from the Swedish Association for Sexual Education, RFSU, that shows a woman's vagina and the photographs of the transformation of the body from childhood to adulthood.
As you go through your life, school life and in other places, you'll hear people saying all sorts of things about life, and a lot of it will be quite wrong. It'll be erroneous speaking and thinking. You lads have learnt the truth tonight, the absolute truth of the wonderful story of life, how life is handed on.
This is my Sydney neighbour Steve Kilby's story of his sex education.
Actually, when I lived in Dapto, when I was about 9, I remember I started to say to my mother, how am I actually related to my father? Because like you had me and, but how does my father come into this? And she said, oh, there's something coming to your school that you're going to need to go to. And it's called a father and son night. And sure enough, a few weeks later, one night, my father, after we watched TV, my father, and I jumped in the car and went to the community hall in Dapto, and they had a father and son night. And it was this strange mixture of slides and discussion. It didn't really give you all the details. It didn't really fill you in. It didn't tell you exactly what was going on. I remember seeing the sperm of these slides of this sperm, how they look like little tadpoles and the ovum in the woman. Kind of gave you the technical details of how it actually happened, but it didn't actually tell you physically what actually happened. So it sort of left the actual act was not graphically discussed, like the fact that the sort of penis is actually inserted in the vagina and that sperm is this kind of comes out in this fluid and stuff. There was none of that. So I always imagined when I came away from the meeting, I imagined that the man held his penis to the lady's crack, as we said, and these sort of little invisible things came out. And I thought it happened in the bush because kids at school always were talking about they were taking their girlfriend. I heard older kids say they were taking their girlfriends into the bush. So somehow I didn't think it was happening in bed. I thought my father was taking my mother out into the bush to conceive my brothers.
A Taste of Bullets and Condoms, a short history of sex education in Australia through the eyes of Swedish-born journalist Johan Gabrielsson, next week on Hindsight. And you can also catch Johan on Life Matters, where he'll be a guest on their regular Friday talkback segment, which this week is all about sex and teenagers. I'm Michelle Rayner. Look forward to your company next week here on ABC Radio National.
G'day, it's Michael Cathcart here from Bush Telegraph. You can catch us online and listen to the programs we've made all this past week. We've been in Menindee, we've been to Wilcannia, we've talked to Barkindji people and found out what their country means to them, and we've unravelled some of the mysteries of the Menindee Lakes. We've heard the sounds of that water crashing on a beach that have been silent for 7 long years. Do join me here online for Bush Telegraph. That's abc.net.au/rn.